We are in Boston at the Park Plaza Hotel. This is the 33rd annual Cognitive Science Conference, CogSci 2011.
That's right.
And we're sitting with Art Markman, who's actually from the University of Texas, editor of the journal Cognitive Science. And interestingly, the Annabel Irion Worsham Centennial Professor of Psychology and Marketing.
That's right. That's right.
So how are those things put together?
Well,
you're also on a blog of Psychology Today.
That's right. And Huffington Post and Harvard Business Review. So it all fits
right.
in.
So
somehow.
All that fits together.
I think so I started out as a researcher doing work on how people make comparisons, how they form and use analogies, how they compare things that are merely similar to each other. And when you do research in a topic like similarity, there's an obligatory first paragraph that says, we study similarity not so much because we care about people's judgments about similarity, but because similarity should tell us something fundamental about how people form categories and make decisions and solve problems. And I always viewed that paragraph as a promissory note, that if you actually learned something about similarity, you would be able to go back and say something interesting about categorization or decision making or problem solving. And one of the areas that I started doing work in was to say, well, how could you take what we learn about similarity and understand decision making? And so in particular, one of the things that came out of some of my early research that I did with Deirdre Gentner was this idea that when people make comparisons between pairs of things, that they tend to focus not only on what those things have in common, but also on the differences that are related to what they have in common. So imagine that you walked into a store to buy a computer, and you know, the computers both have memory on board, but they might differ in the amount of memory. One of them has 4 gigabytes, the other has 2 gigabytes. Those kinds of differences, they are what we call alignable differences, because they come about based on what things had in common. Those become very important in comparisons relative to differences that that sort of hang off of one of the objects but not the other. So if one of the computers had a built-in webcam and the other didn't, now you'd have a property of one that simply didn't exist in the other, and that's non-alignable. And systematically, in judgments of similarity, these alignable differences, like the amount of memory, play a greater role in people's assessments of similarity than these non-alignable differences. And so that led to this very straightforward prediction that if people were making choices among some set of things and they compared the options, that they would also pay more attention to the alignable characteristics than the non-alignable ones. And so I did some studies first with Doug Medin and then later with a graduate student named Shi Zhang, looking at these kinds of decisions. And we found, in fact, that it's a very strong effect. People, even when there's some property that people think is incredibly important a priori, they discount these properties if they're unique. And this actually ends up having implications not just broadly for the way people make decisions in trying to understand the research, but it has practical implications. If you are designing products or designing marketing campaigns around products,
right,
then you don't want to emphasize a unique property that your product has relative to the competition unless you can find some way to actually make it alignable with the properties that the competition has, because people will systematically discount those factors. And so as I began to realize that when you start thinking about basic research in an area like decision making, that it begins to have implications not just for scientists who are doing this kind of work, but really has implications for practitioners who are concerned about these kinds of issues, I started publishing some amount of work in the consumer behavior literature, which really comes out of the academic marketing literature. So in business schools, they have a variety of departments, and one of them is a marketing department. And a subset of faculty in marketing do consumer behavior research, which is essentially a kind of applied cognitive and social psychology. And so I started doing some research in that area. And in fact, Shi Zhang was a graduate student in marketing at Columbia when I was on the faculty at Columbia University for some years. And so he did these very clever studies trying to address issues in that marketers had been worried about. So for example, it turns out that if you look at consumer product categories, that the leading brand in many categories has been the leading brand for ages. So for example, Gillette razors are the number one brand of razor, and they have been the number one brand of razor for 75, 80 years, right? And so the question is, why does that happen? Well, some of it has to do with economics, access to distribution, things that a cognitive scientist couldn't possibly care about. But some of it has to do with the psychology of it, that the first brand that you encounter, which is usually the most prominent one, sets your representation for that product category. And now everything else that you learn about is learned about with reference to that thing that started off as the center of your category. And the alignable properties between these new things that you learn about, these new products, and the one that, that structured your category, those alignable properties will stick. But if a brand comes along that has this great property, but it's non-alignable, people don't learn about it.
Oh, this is fascinating, but give me an analogy from cars. I mean, because you'd think that Ford would be Gillette, right?
Well,
but there's so many cars out there now that the market has changed completely. I mean, people buy Nissans and
that's right.
And why hasn't that happened in the same way as with razors and so on?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways it has. That is, a lot of these new brands are still, you know, niche kinds of brands. I mean, I think that while you have Hyundai and Kia and all sorts of other things, they on the one hand they're not really dominating these markets. But on the other hand, one of the things that happens in a lot of product categories is that you get a convergent evolution of the products. So you can compete successfully with the early brands, but you have to do it by being better than them at their own game, not being better than them at some new game. So you have to be better than them alignably. And so if you think about the fact that Toyota, for example, recently became the leading car brand in the world, and which clearly took many years and took market share away from Ford and GM and all of these other companies. What they did was systematically to be better along the same kinds of properties that had made Ford and GM and Chrysler great sometime in the past, so that they were able to produce cars that were more reliable. That's alignable. Reliability is alignable. They had better, other kinds of features. Their ride was smoother. They could produce the cars, at a reasonable price. And so they weren't trying to create properties of these cars that had nothing to do with what Ford and GM and Chrysler were doing. They were just being better at their game. So you can compete successfully. It isn't the case that the first market leader has to stay the market leader, but you end up having to beat them at their own game.
So give me some sense of you edit the journal.
That's right.
Cognitive Science.
Yeah.
So in other words, all of the leading edge stuff that people think is important at this point comes over your desk first.
That's right.
So you're in a great position to give me, not only as a blogger and opinionator on Huffington Post and Psychology Today, you also get all these opinions coming in.
That's right.
What's the most vibrant thing happening in the field right now? What's the state of the cognitive science?
Yeah, on the positive side, I mean, it's all positive, but one of the things is that the cognitive science is thriving right now. I mean, over the last 6 years as I've been editor, we've doubled the number of submissions that we get to the journal every year. And I should say out front that the journal Cognitive Science is a very special journal in the sense that we really strive for papers that wouldn't have a home in lots of the other disciplines that make up cognitive science. So there's lots of great research that's just good cognitive psychology or good artificial intelligence or good philosophy of mind, but wouldn't necessarily have that draw across disciplines. And so the papers that we really want from people are the ones where some cognitive psychologist has also taken a computer model and derived predictions from their work from that kind of computational framework.
How do you define the field then? I mean, for a layperson at home, I mean, they can go to the Society for Neuroscience. We just said there's AI journals, there's NIPS, there's all these.
That's right.
What is the defining characteristic of cognitive science in your view?
Well, I think what makes somebody a cognitive scientist as opposed to someone who works in a cognitive science related discipline is someone who really wants to draw insight from a variety of disciplines that all come together. So there are some people who are content to be psychologists. They're gonna primarily read the other psychology papers. They're going to think about things primarily in terms of the way that people have traditionally done experiments within psychology. But what cognitive scientists really end up doing is saying, the problems of mind are too hard to believe that we're going to solve them only by taking a single perspective. In fact, if we could have taken a single perspective and solved the problem, we'd be done by now. And so instead, what we say is, I need to understand something about linguistics, about the structure of language, and I need to understand something about computation and computational procedures, and I need to understand something about what the brain is doing at the neurophysiological level, and that by integrating all of these perspectives, that makes me a better psychologist. And so I'm really reaching out for insights across disciplines in order to be able to do my work. And the papers that we want to publish in our journal are the ones that really reflect that kind of reaching out across disciplines in order to get insights even within research that has a strong disciplinary component to it.
Yeah. Interestingly, you mentioned earlier Deirdre Gentner,
yes.
With whom I spoke last year. There was also, as you know, yesterday a lecture by Judea Pearl.
That's right.
It was followed by something by Jay McClelland, which was a sort of remembrance of David Rummelhart.
Yeah.
And in the David Rummelhart picture at UCSD was Deirdre.
That's right.
So there's this interesting community is built up over the years.
Yeah.
But it's only 30 years old, isn't it? 40 years old?
Yeah. It is. It's a fascinating evolution
but
of
very
ideas.
Very fast growing.
Yes. I think that the perspective that cognitive science brings is one that people really resonate to as they begin to open themselves up to thinking about this kind of cross-disciplinary work. And so, you know, I think in the 70s with things like the Lindsay Norman Rummelhart group, which was what that picture was showing, that was an initial shot of people really trying to take seriously what linguistics would have to say about the nature of people's underlying mental representations. And how that linguistic work would interface with computational procedures, trying to get a computer to model some of these kinds of behaviors. And then at the same time, really trying to do psychology research to understand how people end up being influenced by all those factors. And so you had this kind of, at that point, three-legged stool. And that group was incredibly successful in integrating those kinds of procedures. And many of the people in that group played an instrumental role in the 70s in leading to the creation of the Cognitive Science Society and the Cognitive Science Conference. And since then, we really have blossomed as a society. I was the executive officer, actually, of the Cognitive Science Society from 2000 to 2002. And at that point, the society had about 1,000 members. The annual conference had 300 people coming to it, and we really started making clearer what the contributions, the intellectual contributions, were within the field, and reaching out to psychologists, reaching out to linguists, reaching out to people in the computational community. And this year's meeting is somewhere between 1,100 and 1,200 people.
Right, but it's interesting to me. I mean, some of this is obviously the result of the energy that Bob Glushko and people like that have put into the thing, the whole, and the governing board.
Well, and the journal.
But you're professor of psychology and marketing. Your own discipline has to be marketed.
That's correct. Absolutely. The days of thinking that what you could do is to hang out your research somewhere and people would come and find it, I think are long gone. I think that most of us in science recognize that ideas are our currency, but you've got to let people know what you're doing, and you have to let people know inside your own discipline. You have to let people know what's going on outside of your discipline, but within the broader scientific community, and then you have to let people know what's going on outside of the scientific community altogether, so that they can understand that the kinds of research, the kinds of work that we do have tremendous practical applications. And one of the things that's been fascinating for me over the 20 or so years of my career is that I think cognitive scientists spent a lot of their time talking to other cognitive scientists, primarily for many years. And one of the emerging trends has been that the world has gotten more interested in the cognitive science related disciplines.
Right.
You see this in the media. David Brooks finally discovered psychology. Obviously Malcolm Gladwell has been extraordinarily successful at bringing a lot of insights from cognitive science to the broader world. And the cognitive scientists themselves have begun to step out and to try and engage with a broader community of people to let them know that there are things that we've learned that would make their lives demonstrably better if they knew them as well.
Let me ask you two things. I mean, one of them is in conversation, we talked about the phrase you have, tithing to cognitive science.
Right.
So I want you to unpack that for me because that's part of what you've just been talking about. But the second thing is, and we'll get to that later, the underpinnings of all of this isn't it neuroscience? I mean, isn't that the fundamental underpinnings of all of this? I mean,
So I'll take the second part first, then I'll get back to tithing to cognitive science. Neuroscience is incredibly important. We think with our brains, but to say that cognitive science is fundamentally neuroscience would be equivalent to saying that baseball is essentially kinesiology. Right. There are lots of factors that influence any kind of behavior that we engage with, and being able to do good neuroscience is going to involve at some level. I mean, I have colleagues at the University of Texas who study the way that proteins fold in receptors change their affinity to particular neurotransmitters. Fascinating work, but getting from that all the way up to the level of behavior is a long way to go. I was the interim director of our brain imaging center for a year at the University of Texas. And, in order to do good brain imaging research, you also have to understand something fundamental about human behavior. Because at the end of the day, if there's some neural signal, whether you're measuring it as an EEG through the scalp or as blood flow in an fMRI or PET, or whether you're actually doing single cell recording, at the end of the day, you've got to be able to correlate those signals with something that's observable in the world, whether it's a person's behavior or some stimulus out in the environment. And the less you understand about human behavior at the level of psychology, the worse job you're going to do at being able to figure out how to correlate that behavior with some underlying measure of neural activity. So, and in addition to that, there are lots of situations in which the brain might do several different kinds of things to accomplish the same result.
Right.
We're having a complex conversation right now, and it's not so clear that there are going to be generalizations at the level of regions of brain activity or other things that are going to help us to really fundamentally understand the nature of what goes on in these kinds of conversational processes. And the best level of explanation for those things might turn out to be a level of explanation that is a traditionally psychological level of explanation or a traditionally computational level of explanation.
Right, but you've read Edvall's papers on voodoo
sure.
and so on and so forth. You know that the general public is more moved to believe some concept if it has an fMRI diagram in there.
Sure, absolutely, but that doesn't make it good science. Cognitive neuroscience is going to play an increasingly large role in the way that we do our work. But I think that if you look at the trajectory of this kind of research within the scientific community, what you see is that we've gone from, let's just see if we can figure out something that the brain is doing, to really trying to understand the relationships between activity that's happening in your brain and the much more complex ways of thinking about cognitive processes. You have people like John Anderson who are taking these complex ACT models, right? His cognitive architecture model, which is a computational framework, it's a computer model, but then he's trying to find ways of correlating elements of that model with the underlying brain activity.
Right.
Now, is the goal to understand the brain? Is the goal to understand behavior? It's to understand both. And a cognitive scientist would say it's not, there is no primacy of one versus the other. All of these things are providing leverage for us to be able to understand this totality in greater detail. We need the computational procedures to understand what the brain is doing. Sometimes the brain can help us to disambiguate different proposals for the way that things are happening at the psychological level. And sometimes we actually need to think about the philosophy of all of this, right? I mean, you know, there's a tremendous upsurge in research on things like moral reasoning.
Right.
Now, understanding what the brain is doing in moral reasoning tasks will be of interest and will help us out. But is the goal really just to understand the brain regions that are involved? Or is it also to understand at, say, a more psychological level of description, how do you best characterize the way that people approach moral reasoning tasks? And how might those change cross-culturally, and what are the cultural influences? So, I mean, another discipline that's central to cognitive science is anthropology. You know, and you know, if you read a typical paper in the psychology literature, the participants in those studies are college undergraduates because they're plentiful where most cognitive scientists live, and so they're easily available as research participants. But the introduction and the conclusion to the papers that people write talk about what people do, not what Western educated college students do. And so we need to understand the range of possibilities in human behavior, both at the level of the language that people speak, as well as at the level of these kinds of cultural ideas that people bring to bear. And there's a tremendous amount of research that goes on where people end up looking at these influences cross-culturally. And it's going to be important to understand those things, because it is equally true that if all you do is to study the brains of Western-educated college students, then you may end up making generalizations about the way the brain works that really reflect the way that the brains of Western-educated college students work. And without understanding all of these other kinds of cultural influences, you might end up misinterpreting the way that the brain organizes itself. You might assume that there's something natural about a particular organization that really reflects the natural mode of organizing neural activity in a Western culture, where some elements of what the brain is doing might organize in a very different way if you were growing up in an East Asian culture, or if you were growing up in a hunter-gatherer Aboriginal Australian population.
So do you look for that, those kind of try and avoid those kind of biases, inbuilt biases, when you're looking for papers? I'm thinking also about it's a great point you made there. It's a point that's also made in most science journals, is that most of the experimental animals are male, for example.
Right.
So
right.
What's that about?
Yeah.
So, in terms of the sample population that you start with,
yeah,
is there anything you can do with your journal that allows you to correct that skew?
I think the one thing that cognitive science has always tried to do is to try and deal with the trade-off between internal and external validity in research. So I wrote a paper several years ago with a colleague of mine that I called the optimal level of fuzz. And the idea was that if you think about the way research gets done, and I think this is true in every discipline, but let's stick with cognitive science for a second. There is some research that is too fuzzy. You know, you go out and you just watch what people are doing, and then you make up some explanation. And you might have a lot of external validity there. That is, you really are capturing something about what people are doing out in the world.
But you end up with a just-so story.
Yeah, you have no experimental control.
Right.
On the other hand, there's a tremendous amount of research that's too unfuzzy. Right, it is highly controlled, done in very pristine laboratory circumstances, and you can say without a shadow of a doubt that this experimental manipulation caused this difference that you observed, but who knows if anyone would ever do anything remotely like that out in the real world. And so, you can think of this as a continuum, And my belief is that the best research, the really good leading edge research, is those stuff that really seeks this optimal level of fuzz, that really tries to push the envelope by finding things that do resemble what people are doing out in the world, and then doing the best job possible to control as much of the circumstances as you can, which means using computational models to really constrain your understanding of the way that people behave. There's a lot of great research that looks at things like ideal actor and ideal observer models, where these are mathematical models that basically state what it is that ideally someone should have done in this circumstance, and then you can measure people's actual behavior against the ideal. And that helps to take some of the fuzziness out of the work. And so if you hit that optimal level of fuzz, you end up being able to make a really new statement. Now, the problem with that optimal level of fuzz is that if you have reviewers who are biased to be unfuzzy, they're going to look at that and they're going to say, you know what, there's still stuff that's not completely well controlled there. And the people who are way on the fuzzy end of things are going to say, I don't know, have you really captured what people are doing out in the world? And so at Cognitive Science, one of the things we want to do is to promote using this optimal level of fuzz, which means you're not going to please everybody. Right? And so a good cognitive science paper, you know, is going to make the unfuzzy people in the world a little uncomfortable. It's going to pull them out of that zone of everything being extraordinarily tightly controlled. But it's also, you know, it's also not necessarily going to approach exactly what it is that people are doing in the world. And so that's really the level that we want to hit. And there aren't a lot of journals that play that game. Right, there are a lot of journals, particularly say in my home discipline of psychology, that are extraordinarily unfuzzy. They want every last detail to be controlled beyond belief. And I have great respect for that kind of research. So it's not that those journals shouldn't exist or that those journals shouldn't have the strategy they have, but cognitive science as a journal plays this very special role of encouraging people to do things that are a little bit different. So one of the things that might mean is if you go off and look at a population that people don't normally study, that's hard to get at, and so it took you a much longer time to do the research, we might give you a pass on some other things, right? In order to encourage you to have done this thing that was different from whatever everyone else is doing. And you know, because it's all a trade-off. You know, if it were easy to study all sorts of populations and to do it with all of these different kinds of techniques, then everyone would do it. So recognizing that it's a trade-off, cognitive science sits in this place where we're trying to really encourage this optimal level of fuzz.
Circle back to the thing that we passed on, which was right. The tithing to cognitive science now.
Sure.
You're talking about communication.
Right.
Essentially,
right.
Here. So and obligation to communicate.
That's right. So as scientists, you know, we wear many hats. I mean, we teach in the classroom. Most of us are employed by universities. We take research grants. We do basic science. And basic science is, you know, basic research in general has come under fire in the United States right now. The politicians are not enthralled with basic research. They want things to be applied. They want to know how is it that you apply this kind of research. Part of the reason that argument often resonates with people is because I think most people don't really understand what research is all about. They don't understand the pathway that leads from some interesting new discovery that someone had because they were following up on questions that have been sitting in a scientific literature for some number of years, and how that eventually translates itself into making someone's life demonstrably better, perhaps sometime in the future. And they don't understand it because we haven't told them. So this is a fault of the scientific community. The scientific community historically has not stepped out of our realm talking to other scientists. And we have this wonderful meeting with 1,100 other scientists. We're talking to each other, and we love to do that. But there's no reward structure associated with talking to a broader group of people. And so if I write a blog, my university doesn't count that towards my merit raise. They want to know, how many grants did I get lately? How many papers did I publish? What sort of service did I do internal to the university? How well did I teach my students? That's my reward structure.
Right.
And that's why I encourage cognitive scientists to tithe to cognitive science, because it really is a donation. What you're doing is taking 10% of your time and using that time to step outward and do something that isn't necessarily going to advance your career on the surface, though it turns out it's going to advance it in ways that are unanticipated when you first start doing it, and I'll get back to that in a second. But to take time and to do whatever it is that's really in your skill set to bring things outward. For some people, that means, you know, giving a kind of, you know, a softer science talk to local high school students, or going to an old age home and giving a talk, or going to the Rotary Club. For other people, it means writing a blog. For other people, it might mean taking a call from someone in the media, right? Whatever it is, do the things that help to bring the first person perspective of scientists to a broader community that deserves to know what we're doing and doesn't currently know what we're doing. And the reason that I said that this is rewarding to you in an indirect way as a scientist is because it turns out that the more that you engage with people outside of the scientific setting, the more that you begin to understand the biases that creep into doing cognitive science research. So I spend some amount of time consulting for companies because in addition to tithing, I think it's a good idea to sell what we know. There are definitely people who don't value information unless they've paid for it. But if you walk into a corporate setting and talk to people, people who are successful in companies are very smart people, they're just not scientists. And a lot of times they've thought about human behavior, because most businesses succeed or fail based on their ability to both organize the people within an organization as well as to provide some product or service that's valuable to people outside the organization, right? So they have a lot of intuitions about people. They just don't have the scientific background. And so when you begin to talk to them about, well, here's what cognitive science knows about something that they care about in their business, they immediately come back with 30 other questions. Of those 30 questions, 27 of them are ones where once you hear the question, you go, oh, that relates to this other area of research. And you can actually fill in some of the gaps in their knowledge based on existing research. But about 10% of those questions are ones that are answerable, but nobody's really bothered to study them. And so it ends up broadening your own research perspective, because sometimes after one of these conversations, you go back to your own lab and you say, now, why haven't we ever studied that? Why don't we know anything about how some of these things work? And it's because there are questions that slip through the cracks scientifically. They're just the community hasn't necessarily addressed them. And it provides an invitation to think about how you might address those in your own work.
Hmm. How did you get into this business in the first place? I mean,
cognitive science?
Why science at all? I mean, there's always a stimulus for a trajectory, so.
Yeah, I was an undergrad at Brown University in Providence, and I went, my dad's an accountant, so I was assumed I'd do something in business. So I went to college, but I also liked science, and so I went to college with two ideas in mind. I was either gonna be an economist or a physicist, because what did I know, right? So I went and I took an economics class, and I actually took two economics classes, and frankly, I didn't really like. And then I took a physics class, and it didn't like me. And so, and in the meantime, I took all kinds of other stuff. You know, this was the 80s. Everyone thought, well, computers are the big thing. You know, so I waited on this really long line and took a computer programming class, which I did well in and I enjoyed. I took introductory psychology, and I thought that was kind of cool. And I took a linguistics class, an introductory linguistics class. I thought that was kind of neat. I took an anthropology class It was an archaeology class. I thought, wow, you know, that was kind of cool, trying to understand cultures from, and I'd taken all these classes. I thought, well, all this stuff is really cool, but and then, you know, it's now the middle of my sophomore year, and I have this quandary, which is the two things I thought I might want to do were clearly not in my future. And then there were all of these other things I thought were incredibly cool, but you know, one of them didn't seem to have anything to do with the other. And so I sat down with an advisor at the university. I said, well, here, you know, I'm supposed to declare a major right now. What do I do? And they said, well, you know, if you look at all these classes that you think are really cool, we actually have a department on campus called cognitive science. And all of these courses count towards that. And I began to think, well, maybe I'm a cognitive scientist. So I declared a major in cognitive science and started taking all these classes. And then an interesting thing happened, which is most of the classes I took were actually computer science classes. I took this whole introductory sequence in computer science, and I took an artificial intelligence class and things like that. And I began to think, well, I really like this stuff. Maybe this is something I'll want to pursue, you know, off into the future. But now, as a cognitive scientist, you have this problem, which is there aren't a lot of cognitive science departments in universities. There are cognitive science programs, and those are more common now than they were 20-odd years ago when I was starting out. And a lot of the cognitive science departments that did exist existed bureaucratically because there were psychology departments where there were two factions that didn't get along with each other, and they ended up splitting into a clinical department and a cognitive science group, right? So a lot of the departments that had very strong cognitive science presence, but not necessarily a cognitive science department, it was just because the psychologists all got along with each other at that university. And so I didn't know which discipline to apply to, and I was taking a Saturn on a graduate seminar in robot planning as an undergrad, and we read a paper that involved an experiment in it. It had a computer model, and then it had an experiment. And the guy teaching the class made a disparaging comment about doing research on people when you're doing artificial intelligence research, and the graduate students, you know, kind of caught on to that disdain and sort of picked up on it. And after about 5 minutes of this conversation, I ended up standing up in class and giving this impassioned defense of doing research on people in order to understand computational intelligence. And as I'm doing this, I'm having this internal running monologue, and that internal running monologue is saying something like, "I think you might be a psychologist." And I ended up after that. I mean, that really was a kind of formative experience. And after that, I decided that ultimately, while I was going to maintain my computational interests, that I was going to end up applying to psychology graduate programs. And so I ended up as a psychologist.
So as you think about this, your own trajectory and so on. I mean, there's a very well known book by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. What do you say to young people now coming into your field? I mean, what's your advice to a young scientist?
Well, I think that there's sort of two pieces to advice. I mean, one is if you're going to be a scientist, or frankly anything else, you got to love what you do. You're going to spend a huge number of hours becoming an expert in it, and then a huge number of hours using that expertise. If you don't like what you're doing, get out and find something that you love to do. So I've had incredibly bright students come through my lab, both as undergraduates and graduate students over the years, who really didn't have the fire for it. And I usually try to have the conversation with them that says, I don't think you love this. You know, find something you love. You're going to be happier, right? Because you get one shot at this, right? One shot at life. You may as well have a good time. So I think that's one piece. But then I think the other piece is the personality psychologists have isolated what they call the big five dimensions of personality, right? And one of those dimensions is the dimension of openness to experience. And some number of people are naturally open. They hear a new idea and they just think, oh, that's cool. Let me, you know. And other people hear a new idea and they just go, that's outside of my range. I think to be a successful cognitive scientist, you either have to naturally be open to experience, or you've got to nurture that element of yourself that might go against your natural tendencies. Because you have to be willing to say, you know, that person over in philosophy has something interesting to say to me, even though I'm not a philosopher. And here's this person in sociology who has something interesting to say to me, even though I'm not in sociology. And here's this other person in a very different area. You know, here's a clinical psychologist who turns out to have something interesting to say to me. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be critical of research. There's a difference, you know, because there's another personality dimension of agreeableness, right, which has to do with essentially how critical are you going to be of things. You can be critical of something and still be open to it. Being open to it just means picking it up and really being willing to grapple with it, even if you end up thinking, well, this wasn't such a good idea. And I think that openness is really crucial for success in a field like cognitive science.
Okay. When you talked about earlier about tithing to cognitive science, there was implicit in that, there was some sense of the role of scientists in society and
yeah.
so on. A question I ask people all the time, and I'm going to ask you it now, is when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah. So what is its rightful place? I think science has two rightful places, right? I think there isn't any single location. I think one thing is that and it's not just science. I think it's there's a real need for basic research. There's a real need to push the envelope of the knowledge that we have. One way to do that is to do it as a scientist, and that means to use the world to give us data to better understand the questions of interest to us. And I love the scientific method. I live with the scientific method, but it isn't the only way. I mean, I think historians have a tremendous amount to teach us about human behavior using historical methods and digging through documents and doing the kinds of things that historians do. And it's basic research. It's motivated by just, there's a question that sits out there that I need to answer. And I think we need to restore basic research to its place of really allowing some number of people in our society to have the freedom to advance our state of knowledge based on the methodologies that are appropriate to their discipline. And so I would want to go further than just let's restore science to its rightful place. Let's restore basic research to its rightful place. Let's give some number of people the freedom to really explore and advance our state of knowledge. Because when you advance the state of knowledge, it opens up new opportunities to try things that no one had thought of before. And you don't, if you knew in advance what it was that we hadn't thought of before, you wouldn't need to do basic research. But the whole point is we don't know what's around the corner. We don't know all of the things that we're going to learn from an understanding of the mechanisms of the human brain. We don't know everything that we're going to discover from a comparison of the variety of cultures that exist in this world. So that's why we need basic research. And so that's one place of scientists.
And I think Einstein said that's why it's called research.
Right, that's right, exactly right. The second thing is that I think scientists have a duty to communicate that. Scientists have a duty to communicate at a minimum, this is the basic research I'm doing. And that doesn't necessarily mean to justify that basic research in terms of its immediate applied application. Sometimes it's a matter of bringing people into the process of doing basic research and letting them understand the excitement that is associated with pushing the boundaries of the knowledge that we have. And so I think that it is important for scientists to engage the public in an understanding of what scientists do, but particularly in cognitive science, where we deal with humans, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge that we have that really will make other people's lives demonstrably better, only most people don't know it. Most people know almost nothing about psychology. So a standard little soapbox thing that I get on is that if you look at the modern science curriculum, which was really laid down towards the end of the 19th, early 20th century, right? Science was a part of that curriculum, but the sciences that made the cut were the mature sciences in that era. So everyone learns biology, chemistry, and physics. And it's not that those sciences are better, it's that they were mature sciences in, 1898 or 1905, right? Psychology had barely wrested itself away from philosophy at that point. If you were to teach a psychology curriculum, you'd say, here, read William James, and now you know psychology. Right? Well, in the intervening 115 years, we've learned a lot of stuff about the way that people operate. I mean, and some of this research has roots that now go back 40 or 50 years, the heuristics and biases tradition of Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, or the social psychological research on diffusion of responsibility, or some of Stan Schachter's great, social psychological research. We've learned a tremendous amount. but the curriculum hasn't changed. So you're still learning biology, chemistry, and physics, which means that you get to the end of your education career, and what do we ask you to do? We ask you to go out into the workforce. If you go through college, right, you've been in school for 17 years, and now, even without a postgraduate degree, 17 years, and now you're going to go out in the workforce, and what we're going to ask you to do is to think for a living. And then we're not going to give you any of the scientific research on how that thinking works, so that you're going to have to figure it out for yourself. And that's ludicrous, right? So if we systematically go out and teach people about thinking, look, this is the way your mind works. This is the way memory works. This is the way you're naturally going to want to make decisions. This is how problem solving works. These are the basic dimensions of personality. This is why, you know, take a personality test. Now you may learn a little bit about why it is that you tend to react in particular ways to certain circumstances. You know, here's the observation that 90% of your life is done by habit, right? So, you know, you don't go to the store and make decisions on every single thing at the store shelf. You know, 9/10 of what you put in your grocery cart as you walk through the store is the stuff you bought last time. You're trying to get out of the store as quickly as you can, so you start pulling stuff off the shelf. And about 1 in 10 things that you buy in the store actually involves some deviation from your normal habits. Most people aren't thinking about any of those things. And the more that you know about the way you think, the more that you have control over some of those levers to think differently, if you choose to. So why can't we as a field go out and provide a little bit more of this knowledge, give people more insight into what's going on under the hood so that they have more levers for influencing their own behavior? Because the funny thing is, when people talk about psychology, they say, well, you see, the problem with psychology is it's not an exact science, right? Physics, we can predict everything with absolute, you know, certainty, which of course, you know, the physicists say, well, no, I mean, you know, you by principle, if I know the momentum of a particle, I don't know its location, right? So even the physicists know there's stuff that they can predict, there's stuff they can't predict. But what people really mean when they say, well, physics is exact, is if you go hundreds of years back in science and you go to Newtonian physics, you can predict things. Well, great. If we go 50 years back in psychology, we can also predict a lot of things, right? We can do a good job of predicting the kinds of things that people are going to do when they're making choices, for example, based on the research that was done in the 70s and the 80s. Right? So I'm not saying that scientists have to try and make recommendations about how people should change their behavior based on the research that got done last year. That research is still at the leading edge. We still need to hash that out. That's what it means to be at the leading edge of research. But if each of us reaches back 10 years to things that we take for granted, then we can tell people things that really will work, that really are a reflection of the way that they act, and they can change their behavior as a result of it.
Right. You mentioned history in there, historians. One of the questions I like to ask people is to get some sort of contextual sense as well. Sure. Is that if I gave you a time travel token and allowed you to bring to your dinner table anybody from any era, somebody you want to have a conversation with, ask questions of?
Huh. Anybody springs to mind? Well, that's an interesting question. So I think that so much effective thinking is the result of expertise, acquiring knowledge. I would love, so for example, I'm a saxophone player in my spare time, and I would love to have a conversation with John Coltrane, right? Because here's a guy who spent hours practicing and hours thinking about scales and hours thinking about the relationship between the music he was playing and other aspects of his life. And while it would be interesting, partly as a sax player, just to be able to pick his brain for a while, from the standpoint of understanding really good, smart thinking, right? What does it mean to be the world's leading expert in something, right? And to really, you know, to think about, well, yeah, here's someone who has reached a pinnacle and really pushed an envelope, right? What allowed that to happen?
So I suspect that in there is the answer to another of my questions, which is that if you hadn't been a scientist, what would you have been? I guess a musician, which we get an awful lot from, yeah. by the way, from scientists, an awful lot of them are not frustrated musicians, but certainly part-time musicians.
Well, I think that science, fills a particular need that a lot of us have, right? An intellectual need, but there's also, there's also an emotional need, right? And music, while it has a richness and a theoretical richness to it, also has an expressive richness that often is not something that can come out in a scientific paper. It's hard to write a truly expressive scientific paper.
So, last question. What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? I'm certainly optimistic about, I mean, just as a scientist, I'm optimistic about the science. I mean, I will say that. So, the fact that, David Brooks and Malcolm Gladwell and a host of scientists have reached out into the world and said to people, you can live your life better if you know a little bit about what cognitive science has to offer, is something that makes me optimistic because all of us, I think, have, some higher idealistic component to our lives. And certainly early in your career, you just want a job, right? But at some point in your career, you wanna answer the question of what can I say in my career and in my life? And if you only talk to other scientists, that's one role that you can have, one thing you can say. But cognitive science is now, I think, well placed to actually benefit the lives of lots and lots of people. Students, the work that Carol Dweck and her colleagues do at Stanford on mindsets, right? Which, if you just teaching kids that almost everything is a skill to be acquired, not a talent that you had when you started, right? Because time on task is so important in how you ultimately perform in something, whatever it is, that kind of research that if you let people know about it now changes their lives for the better, mm-hmm. right? We are so well placed to do that right now, and we're starting to do it. And that, that really means that all of us have the chance not just to influence the 1,100 people walking around this meeting, but everyone else too. And that's something that I think 20 years ago when I started, I didn't see that as a possibility.
So your tithing then is the Huffington Post, Psych Today blog and so on and so forth. That's just getting the word out, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I tithe it and I sell it. I mean, I like to go to companies. I've got a book that's coming out in January.
What's that called?
It's called Smart Thinking.
Oh, what is Smart Thinking?
So Smart Thinking is essentially developing smart habits that allow you to acquire lots of knowledge and high quality knowledge, and then using that knowledge when you need it. So basically, lots of us have thinking habits we're unaware of. So we need to understand those habits to change them in ways that will make us more effective. We then want to learn causal knowledge. We need to really acquire a lot of knowledge about the way the world works, which is not easy but doable. And then we need to understand the basic principles of analogy, to understand how to take knowledge from one area and apply it in another. And the book is all about, here's the psychology of these things, and then here are some very concrete exercises and principles for trying to do this more effectively.
What kind of exercises, for example?
So as one example, a lot of us have much less good quality information about the way that the world works, right? So Frank Kyle and his colleagues and students at Yale did some great stuff. If you ask somebody, how a flush toilet works, they'll say, oh yeah, I know how a flush toilet works. You say, okay, tough guy, how does it work? And they start in the explanation, and at some point the explanation has gaps in it where you say, well, the water kind of goes out through the bottom of the tank somehow,
and then it ends up in the bowl somehow, and some of it goes away somehow, and I don't really know. It turns out I don't know how that works. And so the more of those gaps that you have in your knowledge, the less effective you could be at using any of those principles to solve some other problem, because now you have this illusion that you knew something, you don't actually know it. So in order to cover those gaps, you have to be a teacher. And in particular, you have to make sure you teach yourself, which means that whenever you encounter a new situation in which there's something that you ought to understand how it works, don't just listen to an explanation, don't just nod there, don't just look at it and go, oh yeah, I get it. Explain it to yourself, right? Teach it to yourself. Find the gaps, because you know anyone who's taught knows that the best way to learn something is to try and explain it to somebody else, because it immediately brings to light all of the things that you thought you knew and you don't. So, you know, one of the things that I do is to get people is to give people some exercises to learn to teach things to themselves, to recognize where to learn to recognize where the gaps are in their knowledge, so that they can fill them, because then they have better knowledge.
Which is the aim of what this is all about, right?
Exactly, right.
Cognitive science. And yeah. It's been great fun talking to you.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for the time.